I'm Brady Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, just a month out from the election, Superintendent of Public Instruction Chris Rakedahl is saying he would back an income tax. That seems like a bold strategy. Plus, a new study highlights the cost benefit of the state's climate policies to middle class families. And we now know just how much Bob Ferguson spent unsuccessfully prosecuting police officers. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Hello and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here on this Tuesday. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. Worked out well today because I was like, let's open. We're doing our documentary tonight. It is streaming live across all platforms at 7 p.m. Pacific time. The documentary, again, is called Operation Indoctrination, A Story of Academic Decline. And this is something that's tied to certainly the Olympia School District and our coverage of that district and some of the political and social indoctrination that's been going on in schools. But it worked out well because we're going to tease that off the top of the show. And then we just so happen to have all these education related stories going on today. And so what a perfect day to air an education related documentary on a day where we have a lot of questions about the state of our education system. So let's get there. So Superintendent of Public Instruction, Chris Rakedahl, he's a month out, roughly a month from ballots going out, right, from his reelection campaign. So he's a two-term head of our state's public school system, and he did not perform well in the primary election, not in the slightest. So he's certainly vulnerable, which is why I found it fascinating that he comes out, again, a month before ballots, not even a month before ballots arrive, and says that he would support a state income tax to help pay for education. And I'm thinking, is there anything more unpopular in the state of Washington than a state income tax? And not to mention that it's against the state constitution, so you couldn't do it anyway. It would have to be approved by voters, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, so he comes out, he's got this new funding proposal, and he says, look, I need a lot of money. And if I don't get a lot of money, then educational outcomes are just not going to be there. Here's a part of his ask.
I need $4 billion to get schools to the national average. I need $4 billion to get us to Massachusetts levels. I need more than $4 billion to get us to 50%. That's not what we're asking for here. We're asking for less than that, sensitive to the fact that the legislature doesn't have that all at once. And even with what we're requesting, $2.9 billion in the first biennium, $4.9 billion in the second biennium, that's going to be a challenge. And I recognize that. I am grateful always to our lawmakers from both sides of the aisle. It is a brutal time to serve. But you do it because you know you can have impact, and the consequences could not be greater than they are today.
So he says he needs $4 billion to get us up to Massachusetts levels, to get us up. Well, this is wild to me. So first of all, we'll get into his ask and who he thinks should pay for all this. He wants $2.9 billion in additional dollars for the 2025-2027 education budget in the state of Washington. First of all, we've talked repeatedly about how test scores are in the toilet and enrollment is declining. Yet Chris Rakedahl doesn't want to address any of those things. The Seattle Times, don't take that from me. The Seattle Times said it. The Seattle Times said he doesn't like to take accountability. That's why they didn't endorse him before the primary. They endorsed one of his opponents. And he never wants to admit or acknowledge some of what's happening with the focus on political and social issues as you have, you know, failing grades for the state in the area of English language learning, math, and science. So failing grades because of that, I think declining enrollment, more parents saying, I'm done with the public schools, I'm going to homeschool my kids, or I'm going to come out of pocket for the cost of a private school. And this guy has the audacity, after not taking accountability or responsibility for the decline of our education system and the state it's in, saying, hey, you got to give me more money. We need two, not just more money. He says $4 billion, but he's like, that's not realistic. So $2.9 billion. Oh, and by the way, I think that we need to raise taxes in order to pay for it. And he says that first and foremost, it starts with the rich paying more.
You know, as a constitutional officer, my job is to submit a budget. The state law doesn't say revenue, but I've never shied away from that. In prior budget requests, I offered up capital gains before it became the law. As a legislator, I offered up tax on profits instead of gross receipts for businesses to help small businesses. I'll be there for every conversation of revenue. I do think we need to change the equation in Washington state. decrease our dependence on property taxes and sales tax and increase our concept of drawing dollars out of those who have the most. That can come in the form of capital gains, that can come in the form of income, a profit. You could even make progressive sales taxes.
Income profit, which is just an interesting phrase. So rich need to pay for this. Rich need to pay more, you know, ignore the fact that the way that I'm running the public school system and have been running it for the past 8 years isn't successful. Test scores are down, enrollment's down. We just need the rich to throw more money at this problem. More on capital gains in a moment. But he said unequivocally, you know, forget capital gains and the rich paying their share, fair share. He wants everyone paying more for education through an income tax.
Would you support an income tax to fix this problem?
I have always supported that, provided that the voters get a chance, and they always would, because we have constitutional limits on that. It's considered property right now under the law, so I've always supported that if the voters get a choice.
Yeah. But anyway, so focus back on capital gains. So he's a liberal, right? So he supports, well, he's a progressive, so he supports an income tax. It's just fascinating to me that he'd come out and reiterate that and reinforce that leading up to an election where a lot of taxes are on the ballot. There's an opportunity to repeal taxes. People are feeling overburdened, overtaxed. They're not happy with the state of our education system. And now he's like, I want billions more. I'd support an income tax to pay for it. And then he gets into that issue of capital gains, which, of course, one of the initiatives on the ballot in November is an initiative that would allow you to repeal the capital gains tax, which is just an unconstitutional income tax. They say, well, it's just the wealthy. Only the most wealthy people are paying this, but we know that if it's not repealed, they're going to continue to lower the threshold until all of us are paying it, and until all of us are paying it when we sell our primary home. So he said, he's acting like he's not taking a position on these things. He comes out, says, I need more money, you know, basically don't repeal capital gains in so many words.
We have a big contemplation in front of us this year on the ballot. I encourage everyone to do your own research and vote your own conscience on those. But there's a revenue question or two or three or four already on the ballot. And it's important that people think about that and then think beyond that on what we could do to change from a state that taxes its lowest income consumers or families at 3 and 4 times the rate of our wealthiest. This is the reason we have perpetual budget challenges. And I think it's time to introduce this question of revenue as a daily conversation in our politics and in our budget considerations.
Yeah, but also, you know, no mention, no conversation of how are we spending the money that we already have? Are we spending it to good effect? Are we being responsible budgeters? He doesn't want to call out the party that's been in power for 40 years in Olympia on the fact that every single time they get any ounce of new revenue, they immediately push it out and spend it on other things. They have no semblance of idea about saving and budgeting and not having this ballooning budget where any sort of dip in revenue is this crisis situation for the services that we have. So anyway, he wants an additional $2.9 billion in increased spending for 2025 to 2027. He says that he would spend that on funding for special education, which is a bipartisan agreement that we need more money in special education. But his opponent, David Olson, says we have the money to be able to pay for that. We just need to decide where we're putting the funds we already have. So he wants that additional money, funding for special education, transportation, materials, supplies, operating costs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think one of the reasons this shocks me is the timing of it. You know, I know that he would take all the money that taxpayers are willing to give him, but he has to understand that people are feeling so over. So I kind of love this, frankly, because he has to understand people are feeling so overtaxed, yet he's going to them like groveling despite low test scores and all of these things and declining enrollment for more money in the form of additional taxes less than a month before people get their ballots. I don't know who advised him to do that. That's a really terrible election strategy, but he did it anyway. So Fine. I think that helps David Olson to me. And I asked this in our daily subscriber show poll, which I'll get to later on about, you know, are you willing to pay more in taxes if we need it for education? So we'll see what you guys had to say about this. But it kind of reminds me of what's been going on in these public school districts with the need to close schools. So declining enrollment, it really sped up during the pandemic, but it hasn't let up with the number of parents taking their kids, you know, to private school or doing homeschooling or some sort of alternative school. You know, and I think it's because some parents realized, one, what was happening with their kids in the public school system during the pandemic, because their kids were learning at their kitchen table via a computer screen, and they heard and saw some of the lesson plans and what was going on. They're like, I don't want you in that school. So they took them out and they homeschooled them. And then some parents just realized during the pandemic, hey, this is feasible for me. You know, I had to pick up a lot of the slack for the public education system during the pandemic, so I'm going to teach my kids at home. And then you've got parents taking out kids for social and political indoctrination issues. But it's this pattern. And I think what Chris Rakedahl said about what he wants, despite how bad he's doing in the public education system, is like, still give me more money. We're seeing that in the Seattle public schools as well. So you might recall we've played this clip back to back before. So in September of 2023, I think it was, so about this time last year, there was a Seattle public school board meeting, and one of the members basically told parents, look, if you don't like the way that we're running our schools and what we teach kids and the political and social issues, and she's like flanked, you'll see, she's flanked by like trans pride flags, then you can just take your kids and leave.
If it is so contrary to your values, what is being presented in public schools in alignment with the will of the voting public, you don't have to participate. You can withdraw altogether. Public school is a right that is afforded to everyone who lives in our communities, but no one is forcing you to participate.
Yes, you got the school district that parents come, they're concerned about what's being taught, what's being pushed on their kids, and they're met with this, well, if you don't like it, you can just take your kids and leave. Well, a lot of parents did take their kids and leave. So what happened? Well, the Seattle Public School District ended up with a budget crisis and declining enrollment and the possibility of having to close schools. And that very same council member, it was May of this year, so like October, November, December, January, February, March, April, May. So like 9 months after saying, oh, just take your kids and leave if you don't like it, she's like having a meltdown at a meeting about, oh, we have to go to Olympia and beg for money because we're going to have to close elementary schools.
When we all go together and say, look, here is what we have done, and all what we need now is this funding for these reasons to support our students, and we cannot do that part unless you step up and help us. Right now, we don't have a whole lot to stand on when we have 29 schools with under 300 kids. That's the charge of the legislature has, and getting state funding is very specific about efficiency, which unfortunately means that they don't care how many schools we have. It's just about the students, and it's up to us to figure out how best to serve the students within the resources that we have.
Well, gosh, maybe an idea would have been not verbally attacking parents who had some legitimate questions about what the priorities were in the Seattle Public School District. Maybe if you hadn't done that a year ago, you wouldn't be in this situation right now where you have a budget crisis, you're going to close elementary schools. So now, just an update on that story, it came out today. So at one point, it was about 20 elementary schools that the Seattle Public School District might have to close. And so they've been debating back and forth on these plans. The Seattle Times now says that they've kind of retreated from these two proposals momentarily while they sort out which one is best and how to move forward. One of the council members said, I'm taking more time to reflect on plans to bring a consolidation recommendation this October. As a result, I'm canceling upcoming community meetings. I understand the closure of schools is a very serious topic. After receiving thoughtful feedback from many of you, it is clear we need more time to carefully consider our next steps. That's Superintendent Brent Jones. I'm working closely with my leadership team to revise our strategy and ensure any decision we make is sustainable and prioritize the well-being of our student, staff, families, working together to meet our goals. He went on to say, while our financial challenges are real and it's our fiscal responsibility to resolve them, it is very clear we need more time to listen and earn your trust as we resolve our structural deficit and revisit our timeline. I'm sorry our proposed options created anxiety for many families who rely on the key programs and innovations within our schools. We are retooling our plans to address those concerns. It says the board was not expected to vote on a final plan until December. October was critical in the school closure timeline, though. It was when Jones was expected to deliver a preliminary plan to the board. So there are two plans of the plans that are being shelved. And I don't know, what does he plan to do? You can't create money out of thin air, and you can't convince people to come back to the district. I mean, maybe you can try, but that ship has sort of sailed. because of your own school board. So one plan, they were going to close 21 schools and all K through 12 option elementary schools. That would have saved $31 million. The second proposal, they would have closed 17 schools and kept an option K through 12 school open in each administrative region. It would have saved them a little bit less. So they're debating that. But again, I go back to here, you got Chris Reichdahl saying, we need more money, taking no accountability for why there is a budget crisis in the public education system or the failures on the test scores, et cetera. And then you got Seattle Public Schools saying, we need more money. This is horrible. We're creating anxiety for parents. A year after you basically told parents to F off and kick rocks if they didn't like the way that you were teaching their kids. So it's just this, I don't feel bad for them. Unless you're willing to come out and acknowledge mistakes you've made in education, priorities that were, you know, not the right priorities when it came to where you spent your money, and now you're in this fiscal crisis and you want the parents that you badmouthed or the parents whose opinions you don't care about to come to the rescue through more taxes? It's so insane. And all of it underscores why you should absolutely tune in tonight at 7 p.m. for our very first Undivided documentary. It's called Operation Indoctrination. It is going to be streaming live across all of our Undivided platforms, 7 p.m. Pacific time. You can watch it on Patreon, Locals, YouTube, X, and Facebook. And so certainly we don't get into the funding issues that are at play, but we talk a lot about these social and political issues that have seeped into our public education system and how it's leading parents to make other decisions. And I think it also is a very strong argument for school choice, as is this argument about we need another $2.7 billion to continue to prop up a failed public school system. So looking forward to that tonight. We'll talk about it more at the end of the show today. All right. There has been a deep dive done by Discovery Institute into the cost benefit of these lofty climate goals that Governor Inslee has been pushing down for more than 12 years, really, because he was the climate guy, congressman, before he was the climate governor. So we're going to dive into that next. First, I've talked to you guys about my success on the Eastside Weight Loss Clinic program, and I love hearing about your successes as well. I'm down 40 pounds. I started the program about 2 years ago, lost most of that weight in the first 2 months. Man, I get messages all the time. I got a message from my friend and his wife who tried the program. He's down like 70 pounds, and I'm just off my top of my head. I think she was down like 50 pounds. Since this time last year, like just in a year, that's absolutely life-changing. And I think one of the good things about the program is it's not, there's no prepackaged meals or like shakes or drugs or injections. It's really actually pretty simple. They teach you what to eat in the right portions. You follow that strict program for 60 days. You then make some simple lifestyle changes to be able to keep that weight off for the rest of your life, and just a ton of success stories. So if you've been thinking about it, just schedule a 15-minute consultation with Dr. Ryan Coogan and his team at eastsideweightlossclinic.com. That's eastsideweightlossclinic.com. Okay, a couple things on the energy front. So we talked on the show yesterday about the smoking gun. Absolutely, the state of Washington caught red-handed, admitting in an email that these energy credits that are going out to customers right now, a lot of you have probably gotten these $200 credits, were absolutely about influencing your vote in November to keep you from repealing the Climate Commitment Act. We showed you this email that was obtained by Sudalani Madsen that showed from the Department of Commerce that it said, the funds must be deposited into eligible customers' accounts on or before September 15th, before the state votes on the initiative. So they want you to see that credit. And remember, when the energy companies send it out, they're saying, this is thanks to the Climate Commitment Act. And they're sending repeated emails, email after email. Hey, remember, we gave you $200. It's from the Climate Commitment Act. Hey, remember, we gave you $200. It's from the Climate Commitment Act. And so now you have the Department of Commerce explicitly saying, we've got to pay out those funds, send those emails before September 15th, before the state votes on the initiative. So I just wanted to follow up and say, you know, we've reached out to the Department of Commerce. We want to know if they're willing to admit and acknowledge, since they've been caught red-handed, that this was always what this was about. I mean, not that I need them to confirm it. We know that's the case. We know this is a bribe. Bribing people with their own money. But we wanted to hear what they had to say. They're a state agency after all. Nicole, any response? No response from the Department of Commerce. So just updating you on that. Maybe they'll respond tomorrow. Possibly. Maybe they'll respond the next day. I don't know, but we'll continue to follow up. But on that front, when we look at what we know are the is the burden being placed on low and middle class families in our state for these climate initiatives and these climate goals. You know, I've said on this show before that I think there are reasonable people right, left, and center who, if they knew that there was a climate initiative that was absolutely going to have a meaningful impact on the environment, that they'd be willing to pay a little bit more at the gas pump. They'd be willing to adjust energy usage or pay a little bit more on their energy bills. The problem is with a lot of these climate goals, you know, they'll set some sort of goal, pass a policy designed to work toward it that ultimately costs the middle class a bunch of money. But, you know, I think we all have this feeling and this belief that, one, they were never going to be able to meet the goals they were setting. And two, that the cost would not outweigh or the cost would outweigh the benefit of those programs. That in the grand scheme of things, you know, on a worldwide basis, these things are having a minuscule impact on the environment. Well, there is this new in-depth report out from Discovery Institute. It's called The Crippling Cost of Electrification and Net Zero Energy Policies in the Pacific Northwest. It was done by Jonathan Lesser and Mitchell Rowling. So we're going to have an in-depth analysis from Jonathan Lesser about this report and their findings coming up this week on Sundays with Subscribers. We taped the interview yesterday. I wanted to play a clip for you about what they were trying to get to the bottom of in this report. I think there's this real concern that they set these goals, right? Like 20 years in the future, 30 years in the future, when they're not even going to be in office to have to answer to whether they meet those goals. Is there any indication that these goals are even feasible?
Yes, there's an indication, and no, they're not. This is all fantasy. It won't happen. It's impossible. We calculated, just think about the land area that you would need. Well, we calculated that for Oregon and Washington, you'd have to use 30% of the entire land area east of the Cascades to site all the wind and solar. You're obviously not going to do it in near Seattle where people live because heavens, they don't want that anywhere near them. And, you know, it's better to site it where all the deplorables live in the eastern parts of the two states. Well, that's not feasible because there's lots of land that you can't in the eastern parts of the states that you can't build wind and solar on. And then you'd have to build a number of new high voltage transmission lines across the Cascades to get all that electricity to Seattle, Portland, and so forth. You know, and then the other thing is you'd need a huge amount of battery storage. And that's one of the reasons that all the costs are so high. In addition, you have to have enough wind and solar to make sure there's enough surplus electricity to charge the batteries when the wind and solar aren't available. So at night, you're going to need something to replace all that solar because the sun has that annoying tendency to disappear at night. And then there's wind droughts. Last year, for example, in early November, there was a six-day wind drought. Essentially, there was very little wind, and you would have generated almost no wind energy during that period. So there has to be enough storage to do that. Now, you can build pump hydro storage, but that's controversial, and there's very limited places where you can do that in both states. So our analysis focused primarily on battery storage. And again, so you'd have these huge land requirements first. You'd have to build so much wind and solar, it's just crazy. Now, both states are talking about building offshore wind. Well, the problem with that is, unlike the East Coast off the Atlantic, where the ocean depth decreases or increases very slowly, off the coast of Oregon and Washington drops off very quickly. So you'd have to build floating wind turbines. Well, floating wind turbines are three times more costly than the regular offshore wind turbines being built, which are the most expensive form of renewable energy themselves. So the costs would be absolutely prohibitive. And the amounts they're talking about, say 20,000 megawatts of offshore wind, not even close to what you need. We figure you need almost 70,000 megawatts of wind power. So it's just, you know, the whole thing is, it's a complete fantasy.
Complete fantasy, as we knew. But on Sunday's show, we're going to go through like number by number, data set by data set, to really give you an idea of, I hate to say it, but I will, how worthless some of these climate goals are. How the fact they're not even attainable, first of all, and we know that, right? Not even attainable, but in the fake effort to attain them, they will cost you and I so much money for the most minuscule, like 3/1000ths of a percent, of a thousandth of a percent, 0.31000ths of a zero, zero, many zeros, fraction of a thousandth of a percent impact on the overall temperature of the planet. So when you hear it, it's so hard to deny. He's been called like a climate denier and all these things. It's like, no, he just likes facts and data. When he looks at whether a climate policy is worth it in terms of the impact it's going to have on the environment. So it'll be an interesting interview. You can check that out on our Sunday show this week. You can become a subscriber by signing up, undividedpod.com, undividedpod.com, and you can go check out that full report at Discovery Institute. Again, the crippling costs of electrification and net zero energy policies in the Pacific Northwest. It's really interesting read, interesting information. All right, we now know how much Bob Ferguson spent unsuccessfully prosecuting police officers. We'll get to it. First, if you're selling your home at some point this year, get in touch with our friend Wes Jones of sellwithwes.com. He and his team have the best marketing strategy. And also Sharona Rhodes, who's an undivided viewer, she says the staging that they did to sell her home in 6 days for over list price was phenomenal.
So now it's okay, the house is empty and you're seeing all the things that you've never really noticed. Like, oh my goodness, there's a broken baseboard over there. Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness, that looks terrible. You know, and he's like, calm down. Staging will take care of it. Just don't worry about it. They came in and they staged everything. And my 17-year-old daughter just graduated high school. So we went in to look at the house after the stage. And she said, Mom, I would buy this house. You've always hated our house. She said, this house is aesthetic. I love this house. Like, okay, 17-year-old child.
Yeah, well, that's a big part of it, the marketing that goes into selling your home. And there are a lot of other services Wes and his team offer, so check them out. Sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. Bob Ferguson promises he's going to add more money to the budget to hire police officers. Well, I wish we could get back some of the millions of dollars he spent prosecuting police officers. Let's talk about it in our segment, Unbelievable. All right, so we all know that Bob Ferguson is, of course, the public safety candidate. He has suggested as much in his first political ad that he aired on the public safety issue. Here it is.
50th, dead last. Washington has the lowest number of law enforcement officers per capita of any state. That's unacceptable. As governor, I'll fix it. Public safety is my top priority. I'll hire more police and first responders, create a statewide response unit to tackle the fentanyl crisis, and invest the $1 billion I won from drug companies to increase treatment. Washingtonians must feel safe and be safe for our state to thrive.
Man, I agree. What a good guy. I'm so glad that we have a candidate in the race for governor who understands that public safety is a top priority and that we absolutely have to hire more police officers. He also brought it up, by the way, at the debate last week against Dave Reichert.
So Washington State has per capita the lowest number of law enforcement officers of any state in the country. My criminal justice plan details how we're going to change that. In my first budget as governor, we're going to put together a budget that invests $100 million. So local jurisdictions, your cities, your counties, the folks who hire most of the police officers across our state can use those dollars for increased salaries, for signing bonuses. That gets first responders on the streets, that helps solve crimes, and lets the prosecutors in my team, in my office, do the work to send those folks away.
Awesome. And it's so obvious. I mean, Bob Ferguson has a long track record of absolutely supporting the police, and Dave Reichert... What is he, a former sheriff or something? I don't think so. No track record of supporting law enforcement. Bob Ferguson tweeted after the debate that he'd create this $100 million grant program. He said, Dave Reichert? He's trying to distract you from the fact that he opposes pay raises for police officers. He said supporting law enforcement means investing in law enforcement. What a great guy. What a great guy. And of course, as I said, he has a long track record of sticking up for police officers. Like, just as an example, when the Seattle police or the city of Seattle was saying it wanted to defund the police department and voted to defund the police department, Bob Ferguson came out with a very strong statement. Wait a second. I'm all confused. It was CHOP. When CHOP happened and the rioters took over the police precinct, that was when he came out with a really, really strong statement. That wasn't it either? No, I swear. Sorry. I knew what it was. When the police cars were burning in downtown Seattle during the riot in the summer of 2020, and like when police rifles were getting stolen, that's when he had that really strong statement about his support for law enforcement. Yeah, no, of course, you know, he's full of shit. He's absolutely, swear jar, fine, full of shit. He's claiming to be the public safety candidate, has absolutely no track record of supporting law enforcement whatsoever. He's just saying what he thinks he needs to say to be elected governor. He's saying, I'm going to spend all of this money, all your money, hiring new police officers. But that man has spent more money trying to prosecute police officers than he's ever spent or advocated for spending on law enforcement. So the News Tribune has this analysis. I'm so glad they did this. I'm a little hard on the mainstream news. Very grateful for the News Tribune and Peter Talbot for putting this together. The headline, how much did AG Ferguson pay to prosecute the Manny Ellis case? Here's what records show. So, of course, Attorney General Bob Ferguson politically prosecuted three police officers for murder, unsuccessfully so. Was not the first time. Remember, he also unsuccessfully prosecuted Pierce County Sheriff Ed Troyer in a case and didn't win it, and then went on, did this. It was at a time where he thought, well, it'll be really good for my political resume to put police officers in prison for murder, even though they've been cleared in other investigations, but my office will do a better job. Well, he spent more than $4 million failing. It says more than $4 million was spent on legal services, expert witnesses, consultants, a private investigator, and trial expenses from February 2021 through December last year, according to invoices and receipts released to the News Tribune through a public records request. In the records released to the News Tribune, there were 36 invoices from two law firms totaling $3,367,060.61. First of all, isn't he a law firm? Isn't the Attorney General's office a law firm? Why are you paying more than $3 million to outside law firms when you are yourself a law firm and you've doubled the number of attorneys on your staff since you took office 12 years ago from 400 to 800? The article says, also, there were 32 invoices from expert witnesses, a private investigator, consultants. Their work amounted to $686,000. That includes the expertise of a jury consultant known for his work on the O.J. Simpson murder case. That's weird. Why would the... weren't they trying to prosecute really this case, not lose it? Well, in the Ellis case, he helped conduct a mock trial and traveled to Tacoma from California for jury selection. That brings outside costs to the Attorney General's office in the Ellis case to more than $4 million. It doesn't even factor in how much the Attorney General paid his own employees for time spent working on the case. That includes Assistant Attorney Generals Kent Liu and Lori Nikovla, who helped lead the prosecutor's trial team with Special Prosecutor Patty Eakes, who was hired as a contractor. Again, you have hundreds of attorneys on staff. You shouldn't have brought the case in the first place. But hell, if you're going to bring it as the Attorney General, at least handle it in-house. Spends more than $4 million on this. Oh, and there were some miscellaneous charges in there as well to put police officers in prison for murder, 202 coffees, and over $47,000 in hotel expenses. It says, though daily caps on meal expenses mean that the Attorney General's office didn't pay for every entree or beverage, receipts show that contractors purchased 94 Americanos. God, Tacoma News Tribune is really nailing it.
They are.
Really specific. Thank you, I genuinely mean it, Peter Talbot, for the level of specificity. Mm-hmm. I'm enjoying it immensely. 94 Americanos, 81 lattes, 21 mochas, and 6 drip coffees. The meal caps saved the state $1,699. Also retained were two consulting agencies, Decision Analysis Trial Consultants and Prolumina, which together cost about $250,000. And, by the way, the cost might grow. In April, Timothy Rankine, one of the officers who was acquitted by a jury of his peers, and his wife filed claims seeking $47 million in damages from Tacoma and state officials, alleging he was falsely accused of racially biased policing. The Ellis family's lawsuit against Tacoma and the officers identified as being involved in Ellis's death is ongoing in U.S. District Court. And I hope that they get a payday over all of this, because they had the mayor of Tacoma, who came out long before they had their day in court, labeled them, vilified them, called for them to lose their jobs. They have aspects of this claim that are against Attorney General Bob Ferguson for comments he made for what they felt like was politically motivated prosecution that costs us more than $4 million without even factoring in the cost of the staff attorneys at the Attorney General's office. Yeah. Bob Ferguson, we could have hired a lot of new police officers with $4 million. So save it. Save it. Okay, coming up next, radical transparency in elections. Some states are saying that's the way to push back against claims of election interference and lack of election integrity. We'll get to the story from the Washington Post. First, check out, if you've been hearing our spots for Natchez RV Resort, I mean, it's a beautiful place. It is, even if you don't have an RV, it is such an awesome place, and they now have turnkey park models that are ready to go. So it's a perfect way to make Natchez RV Resort your home away from home. I mean, these things are beautiful too. Like that, I would go there and stay there for the rest of my life if I didn't have to do this show and have to have a job.
I mean, we could do it from there,
probably. We could
probably
do it from there.
I have a nice office.
I gotta say, though, I don't want to be with you in for that.
Like, yeah, that's
in, fair. In that, in close quarters.
That's okay.
I'm just saying, like, for like 7 days a week.
Well, so we could have our own.
You could have your own. I'll have one park model. You'll have the other park model. And then we'll play, we'll meet together on the tennis court. Hang out, you know, make some friends out there, find you a husband, whatever it is. Getting off track, they also have their beautiful 4,300 square foot clubhouse, indoor outdoor fireplace, gourmet kitchen, a ton of area for you and your family and friends and visitors to hang out and lounge. They're finishing up their pool and their hot tub. I mean, they just got a million things. And not to mention, it's in a beautiful area of the state with endless recreational activities for all four seasons and 300 days of sunshine. So make a reservation now to come check out the stunning Turkey Park models and their gorgeous new clubhouse. Or if you've got an RV, come check out one of their available lots. NatchezRVResort.com, NatchezRVResort.com. For the record, I wouldn't want to hang out with my husband 7 days a week in an area. Well, really, I told him at the house either. I love him. But like, is there anyone I want to, besides my dog, that I want to be with like this 7 days a week?
No.
Just my dog.
No, that's the thing. I feel like at this point in my life, I've been single for so long that I need somebody that travels often, because I'm very used to being alone.
Hey, I love the families that are all for like being together. All I'm like, good for you. You know, maybe Mike and I have a strong marriage. This is getting really off track. But sometimes I wonder, is it because we see each other so rarely lately? Haven't seen each other very
likely
much.
Is that's
anyway
part of it.
Let's get to a little bit of national news. This I found this fascinating from the Washington Post, because I don't have a problem with it. I bet you guys, some of you are going to have an issue with it, but you tell me. So the headline in the Washington Post: latest strategy in fighting election skepticism, radical transparency. So it gives some examples of how, you know, of course, after 2020 and, you know, claims by former President Donald Trump and other Republicans across the country that the election was stolen or rigged or whatever it is, you have some distrust in the election system, mostly from conservatives and in the state as well, who don't like mail-in voting, who have issues. I think some of the concerns are very valid. Some of them have been presented with zero evidence whatsoever to suggest that there is some widespread conspiracy. I mean, I think of Lauren Culp, the gubernatorial candidate in our state, who lost by 500,000 votes and was like, I won. I have the evidence and I'm going to show it to everybody and I'm not conceding. And then he never had any evidence. And the state like threatened to disbar his attorney for making these false claims. So his attorney withdrew the loss. It was all this whole mess. But anyway, so this gets into, in Arizona, it gives an example. In, is it Pinal? I think it's Pinal County. Is it Pinal? I think it's Pinal. Somebody's going to tell me.
I prefer penal. Yeah, penal county, Arizona. So they're getting ready for the election, and they've spent all this money on what the Washington Post is characterizing as radical transparency. So for instance, they built a $32 million election headquarters that is more than quadruple the previous space. It has walls of windows so more observers can easily watch the vote counting process. They added more cameras inside and outside to create a bunch of surveillance footage that can be reviewed if necessary. This gets intense. Election workers are now strap GPS devices onto the cages that transport equipment and ballots to and from the polling sites, creating a record of every single movement. The need for this came after trying to disprove rumors in 2020 that a school bus filled with voting equipment had been abandoned in a nearby desert town. And it says the wiring for machine tabulators runs through see-through grates instead of behind drywall so that officials can prove that the equipment is not connected to the internet and possibly hackable, a popular false theory. I gotta say, like, I'm not in favor of spending money needlessly. Some of these things seem like a good idea, like surveillance cameras in the key places where people are handling ballots. That seems, you know, not only good for refuting any sort of claims of misfeasance, malfeasance, but also what if you have someone trying to break into an election area where there's ballots there, whatever it is. Like, yeah, those should be very well surveilled areas. I think we can all agree. You know, having see-through walls to make sure people don't think that the machines are connected to the internet. It's a little much. I wonder how much that costs, certainly. It goes into some of the kind of justification of this. It says the July primary provided a dress rehearsal for the November general election, and officials had to gather evidence to refute false claims. During early voting, Republican activist Boots Hawks, that's his name, Boots Hawks.
I enjoyed that name.
Yeah. Told friends in an email that two Republican candidates were behind in their races, even though election day had not arrived and votes had not been counted. That narrative took off. Pinal County Supervisor Kevin Kavanaugh, who later lost his primary election for sheriff and claimed that the county's elections are not transparent, cited Hawks' correspondence as potential evidence of a crime. He demanded the Arizona Attorney General investigate whether election workers had illegally leaked election results. The allegations were quickly deemed unsubstantiated by the prosecutor's office, which will not open a criminal investigation. But I think it's interesting that there's still, you know, it's about, I think transparency and erring on the side of transparency is always the best idea. And when a concern is brought up, addressing it quickly and head on, not dismissing it outright is like, that's a ridiculous conspiracy theory, but saying, hey, here's why we know that's not true. Here are the steps and the measures that we have in place. Like, yes, please, we allow observers in. If you want to check out the machines, you know, within our policies and regulations, please do that. I think that's one of my concerns I have in Washington State, where there is some, I think, election criticism that I don't believe is valid, that goes a little bit too far. I mentioned the Lauren Culp thing. But, you know, there's always room to be more transparent and also to speak out about instances that are true. For instance, you know, the efforts to disrupt the lawful gathering of signatures. Our Secretary of State, for as much as I think he's done an okay job, he didn't say anything about that publicly. You know, he sent a member of his office to testify on behalf of a bill to protect signature gatherers. But when you see such blatant attempts to, like, disrupt an election, influence votes, and you have people who don't say anything about it because it's their political party doing it, that's what sows distrust in elections. That's what leads you to have to spend $32 million on a new state-of-the-art election headquarters where you've got glass walls and showing people cords and crap. You know what I mean? So I had these states and I think election offices taken more seriously, you know, going back years, some of the concerns or complaints that people had and not just dismiss them outright, I don't know that you would have had such an intense distrust start to form 4 years ago in our election process. So this is kind of the result of that. Like, well, we weren't transparent back then. Now we got to spend millions of dollars on transparent walls. So there you are. I'm curious what your guys' thoughts are on that. We'll get to it in questions and comments, I'm sure. All right, before we get to our daily subscriber show poll, which is about this education funding ask from Chris Reichdahl, remember, happening, God, what day is it? Tuesday? This Thursday, Zach Abraham and his team at Bulwer Capital are going to have another one of their live Know Your Risk webinars. And this is good timing, right? Because remember, the Fed just dropped interest rates. And so there are certainly a lot of questions to be asked about how could this impact your retirement portfolio, what's happening with the markets nationally, et cetera. Zach told us when he was on the show with us last week that he really feels like the Fed's decision to cut interest rates was purely political.
If they truly are data dependent, then the debate should have been whether to not cut at all or to go 25 basis points. Where they came up with 50, there's just nothing in the data that suggests that's what they should be doing. As a matter of fact, you've got multiple inflation gauges that have been ticking upwards over the last 3 months. You've got growth and inflation still above the long-term trend lines. You've got unemployment sub 4.5. There's just nothing there. So I think they're making a huge policy mistake. And I think that you are watching markets, in my opinion, and look, we'll be talking, God willingly, 6 months from now when we have a clearer picture.
Yeah.
But what I'd be willing to bet at this point is that everything's going way higher and inflation's going to reignite.
Yeah, they think it'll help them in the short term for the election, but in the long term, we're all screwed. Well, maybe not that serious, but we'll hope we're not all screwed. Zach Abraham is surely going to talk about this during his live webinar, totally free, this Thursday, 3:30 p.m. Pacific time. If you just go to knowyourriskradio.com, there's a pop-up that'll come on the screen, and you can sign up for it there. You can passively listen, or you can be on and ask questions and all of that. So knowyourriskradio.com, knowyourriskradio.com. All right, let's get to our daily subscriber show poll. I asked you guys, would you support new taxes to help increase funding for our state's public school system? So look, sometimes I ask a question and I'm like, yeah, I kind of know how they're going to respond. But I always expect like a little bit of dissent, you know? This is one of those, not a lot of dissent. 97% saying, absolutely not, Brandy. Absolutely not. Vivian, I saw Vivian this weekend, and she's just so lovely and elegant. She says, heck no, so much waste already on the woke instruction. Brandon Ferris says, enough is enough. I understand inflation, but we can't just keep throwing more and more money thinking it's going to fix the problem. We need teaching reform and to get back to actually teaching the curriculum instead of worrying about social issues. Also, very much looking forward to your documentary, as am I. I always like to be with you guys twice a day. It's always fun for me. But I think you make a good point there. Like, look at this through the lens of anything else. Homelessness, our state's response to homelessness. It's been a failure. And Jay Inslee wants more money. And it's like, okay, prove to us that you are committed to spending money on things that work, not spending money on things that don't work. If you were, and then we'll give you money. So if you were, and I truly mean this, if they were firing on all cylinders in our response to homelessness, they'd really, you know, stolen some of the ideas from other areas of the country that are working, and they were making a substantial impact and showing us that what they were doing was having a positive outcome. And they said, okay, we've got the plan, now we need money. I'm all for it, because the impact to our economy from the homeless crisis, drug crisis, crime crisis is overwhelming. So I'm okay spending money to fix this disaster we're in, because we have to at some point, but I'm not okay with continuing to throw away billions of dollars for no solution. So apply that to the education system. The enrollment is down for a reason. The test scores are down for a reason. So at least acknowledge that this isn't some right-wing conspiracy that our public education system is in crisis, and then say, here's what we're going to do to fix outcomes. Not just continue to tell us that if we only had a little bit more money, then test scores would be better. Like, then enrollment would go up, because we know we're not fooled anymore. We know that's not the case. HTA said, Reichtel would just use that to fund more programs that don't help the basics. Douglas Kramer, almost spit out. When I'm off camera, I have a sinus infection. Like, it is a serious thing. I need to now like go see a doctor,
yes,
because it will not stop. Do you know what post-nasal drip is? I've been Googling a lot. I have post-nasal drip. And when I'm sleeping, it just goes drip, drip. So anyway, I've been off camera, I've been like wiping my snot away. And Douglas Kramer almost caused me to shoot it right at my nose. He says, this is a joke, right? No, it's not a joke. It's a daily subscriber show poll. How dare you suggest it's a joke? Terry Lee says, not just no, but hell no. You know, that's how I feel too. Don't you agree with me, Nicole, that it seems like a very dumb thing to suggest more taxes a month before ballots come out with your name on it?
But I think that's how, well, I think he thinks he's going to win. and he wants this money. So I don't think he really had a choice, because he couldn't ask for less and say, I'm spending the money wrong. Don't worry about it. I can figure it out.
That's true.
So he thinks he's going to win anyway. He talks, you know, he's very smooth. He's a smooth talker. So I watched the most of his press conference there. He says a lot of words that sound like
very
they
Kamala
mean
Harris-y.
Very. No, Kamala Harris is very blatantly word salad. His is not word salad. You almost feel dumb because you're like, oh, why don't I know that word that he just used?
Yeah. Oh, okay. But, so different.
Yeah. So it's a different kind of word salad. But he definitely is a smooth talker. I'll give him that.
I was trying to hide my Starbucks logo unsuccessfully.
Unsuccessful.
I'm not giving them a free commercial.
Well, you just did.
I need to stop getting coffee at Starbucks. Because
we've cut back a lot.
We really have, because usually I just do the two shots of espresso on the little home machine from Costco.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you guys, if they want to sponsor the show, that's fine. I'll drink Starbucks coffee.
There you go.
I'll sell myself out. It's
Come
fine.
On.
Sorry.
I think they have a new CEO. We should.
Two more comments. Sorry, I'm off track. I've been up since 3 a.m. So we're taxed enough. Anna says on X, this state will bleed us dry with taxes if we don't vote for change. Everyone's livelihood's on the line. Reagan on X says they don't deserve the money they're getting now. Why would anyone want to give them more so they can bloat more teacher salaries and continue to fail students? No thanks. I agree. No thanks. Let's see here. Other comments. Baron of Gray Matter, $5 super chat. Baron of Gray Matter has it figured out. Baron of Gray Matter, I might have to institute a rule on super chats. As much as I love getting money, I think I gotta do, if you super chat a bunch, I can only read two, because it's not fair to everybody else, you know? Is that?
It's fine. He's not out of control yet.
We love you. I mean, we love you and thank you. I just don't want to, you know, if somebody's like, I figured this out, if I do a dollar super chat 11 times, it'll be just my comments. I'll use my judgment. These two are fine, though. Baron of Gray Matter, they don't need more money. Don't throw good money after bad. Property taxes are too damn high. Cut all the BS, CR theory, climate, trans, academies only. And then on the climate issue, sorry, Brandy, too many people are influenced by feelings. Too many people influenced by feelings are convinced about this climate scam, climate change scam. They don't believe facts. It's all about feelings. That's true on a lot of things. TZ Burton, maybe schools should teach the three R's instead of trans ideology, BLM, Antifa, standing with Gaza, and all the other BS Democrats push in school. It was interesting. I had Nicole kind of make me a, because we've done so many stories on the Olympia School District. I was like, can you make me a timeline just so I'm not forgetting anything? And it's like this long.
It is.
A timeline of like, oh, students walked out over this and this. And I was like, holy smokes.
We've got two more for them this week. Two new ones.
Yeah, so we're going to have some follow-ups immediately after the documentary on some other things that are now happening. So it's hard to keep up with all of it. Crafty Grandma Crispy, where have you been? It has been a while, right? No?
A little while.
Maybe it's been a while since Nicole chose one of your comments.
Possibly. But no, I think I picked one last week. But I do think gone for a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I think says, recently returned.
I love the sarcasm. You're speaking my language. I'm glad it was obvious. I'm sure there's people, whenever I... and like type sarcasm on Twitter, people are like, how dare you? I'm like, I'm being sarcastic. TZ, oh no, I already did that. Matthew Cook, Bob was bragging about all the attorneys he's hired during the debates, and yet he had to use outside law firms. Exactly. There wasn't some attorneys of the 800 plus that had the expertise, right? The AG's office purposefully used outside law firms so that if you want to sue the AG, it limits the number of firms that are available to hire without a conflict of interest. I've heard about this, that you have all these law firms that are used in some capacity by the state and these on a contract basis. And so then if you're trying to sue the state, all these law firms say, well, we can't represent you because we have a conflict of interest. And so people can't find attorneys. Let me see. Louis Koglis, acupuncture cleared up my sinus issues. You want me to stick a needle in my face?
I don't think they do it in your face. I think acupuncture is, you know, all different places around you. Sometimes it'll be your finger, your foot, your back.
Not doing that either. Okay. There is.
It's really not scary. I have done it. It didn't work for me, but I have done it, and you don't even feel it. It just is like, it's not even like poking yourself with a needle or anything. It doesn't feel like that. You don't even feel it.
Yeah, I mean, I despise vaccines. I like brought to tears just the anticipation of getting a shot. So I'm definitely one of those people.
Somebody else said oregano oil.
I guess I have this fear that like
I'll
be sitting on the table to get acupuncture, and then there'll be an earthquake, and I'll roll off and like stab myself.
They're not needles like that. See, I think people have a misconception of the needles. They're just this little needle with a little spring, and it just goes underneath the first lay of your skin.
No, I don't need that. No, I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to hear about it. Also, can you mute my mic for a sec?
Okay, sure. I got to turn it back on.
Only because I got to sing happy birthday and I don't want it to sound all nasally.
Right.
Now, Nicole, it is a very special birthday. And I know you don't usually like to sing.
I don't like to sing.
But look.
I mean, I do in the car with music that's louder than my voice.
It's Matt Gilbert's birthday.
I know.
And I feel like it would actually be borderline offensive if you didn't join in.
I know. You know what's funny is I don't even think he's in the chat today. He is.
Enjoying his
birthday? I believe I saw pictures at the Mount Rushmore. This morning
that's awesome.
From him. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll sing it in his absence. You don't have to, but I'm just saying that it's kind of not very nice.
Really quick, we just got a $5 super chat from Denise Young. No message, just super chat.
Oh, thanks, Denise.
But yes. Okay, go. I'll sing backup.
You can like give me some claps, or you know what I should get you? We're way off track today. I should get you a cowbell.
Or a kazoo.
Oh my God, I should get you some instrument that you can play that then I don't have to keep shaming you for not singing.
Okay.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Matt Gilberto. Nicole, you ruined it. I'm just kidding. Happy birthday to you. Great. Love it. Happy 31st birthday, Matt. We just love you to bits. All right, let's get to our closing sanity check, shall we? Okay, so California's Democratic Attorney General Rob Bonta was on CNBC's Squawk Box. So he's filed a lawsuit, the state has, against ExxonMobil, accusing them of misleading the public about the environmental consequences of plastic production for decades. Well, Squawk Box pointed out some of the environmental efforts that ExxonMobil has made.
Where 95% of it goes into
landfill.
Sounds
like a better thing than nothing, than going into a landfill and going.
They don't get any credit for advanced recycling. Turning things into jet fuel that's emitted into the air and or transportation fuel and become part of our.
So your point is we shouldn't have jet fuel?
My point is ExxonMobil shouldn't lie, and they shouldn't point to
another
lie.
You flew here though. You flew here though, right?
We travel.
I guess what I'm trying to understand is one.
Oh, you gotta love just their moral hypocrisy. You can never, unless you choose to like go by donkey or horse,
right.
you're just screwed. But ExxonMobil has like been turning, plastics into like
jet fuel.
And he's like, well, that doesn't count because jet fuel goes into the air. And they're like, well, you flew here. So you just got to love it. A reminder, we are airing our very first ever undivided documentary, Operation Indoctrination, A Story of Academic Decline, airs tonight, streaming live across all of our platforms at 7 p.m. Pacific time. We sure hope that you can join us for that. Watch with each other, chat with each other, and we will talk about it quite a bit on the back end during our live show tomorrow at noon. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving Common Sense a comeback and for having fun with us on the show. I had a few people who chatted with me this weekend when I was running across the state who were like, we just appreciate that you have humor. And I said, if we didn't, you know how depressed we would be if we did this show without an ounce of humor and laughed about some of this ridiculousness? I don't think we would have lasted this long.
I don't think so either.
I know you and Dory wouldn't have. He had a sense of humor too, and I don't think he would have lasted all the decades he lasted if he hadn't have like laughed about some of this once. You gotta do it. And plus, I'm just really funny, so it's just
there's that
just totally natural for me, you know.
Humble too.
Humble, beautiful, all whatever, you know. All right, we'll see you guys at 7 p.m. for the airing of Operation Indoctrination. And then we'll see you back in the live show tomorrow at noon. In the meantime, support our show, just $5 a month. UndividedPod.com, UndividedPod.com.